and the prevalence of life-saving medical treatments have made us a long-lived, unhealthy people. What I saw in the Tarahumara was a group of people who ran and ate the way their ancestors had run and eaten. They depended on food that was grown locally and obtained with some difficulty. They ran with abandon and unself-consciousness. They ate meat, but they ate it the way generations past ate it, on the rare occasions they could get it. It was a precious commodity, not a staple. I'm healthier, and I can run longer and faster because I eat a plant-based diet. But I don't preach to my carnivorous friends or lambast anyone who eats a baked potato slathered with butter and sour cream. Anyone who pays attention to what they eat and how it affects them will naturally move toward plants and toward health. Exercise is simpler and more complicated. We need to move, but should training be an intuitive, free-form affair or a structured science? I try to let science steer my training while staying open to the animal joy of running. I take days off when I feel I need them, even if my training plan doesn't call for it. Ultra runners need to bring all the knowledge we can bear to our training, but we can't afford to be rigid. If there's one thing I can count on in a 100-mile race, it's that I will encounter things I didn't count on. Dealing with physical uncertainty used to be part of life. So did training. We ran toward food and away from predators. We feasted and fasted according to the season. We spent a lot of time walking and napping. Now we sit. We drive and surf on the internet and watch television, and naturally we suffer. A recent study in the Journal of Epidemiology followed 123,216 subjects over 14 years and found that men who spent more than 6 hours a day sitting were 17% more likely to die during that time than men who sat for less than 3 hours. For women, the increased risk of death was 34%. This increased mortality persisted regardless of whether the participants smoked, were overweight, and, this shocked me, regardless of how much they exercised. Humans aren't built to sit all day, nor are we built for the kinds of repetitive, small movements that so much of today's specialized work demands. Our bodies crave big, varied movements that originate at the core of our body. Imbalance comes when we spend all day doing small, repetitive actions like typing, scanning groceries, flipping burgers, or operating a computer mouse. Much of the purpose of structured training, therefore, is compensatory. It's not so much that we need to learn to run, per se, as we need to unlearn bad habits and correct imbalances wrought by the modern lifestyle. The race in Copper Canyon consisted of a few loops along dry, dusty roads at the bottom of the canyon, up 2,000-foot climbs studded with grapefruit and papaya trees, past towering rock formations. We ran through town 3 times, past locals drinking and laughing, and through the happy, tiny sounds of a mariachi band. I hadn't planned on racing so hard. I was on vacation. I kept up my 7-minute pace. I had trained, but these guys had spent their whole lives training, even though they wouldn't have called it that. I wanted to blend my running and my diet as seamlessly into my day-to-day life as the Tarahumara did. I also wanted to win this race. And I knew they did, too. A victory for me would be a great honor. For them, it would represent enough corn to feed an entire village for a year. I increased my pace, and there, around a bend, I caught a flash of electric blue. It was Silvino in his traditional Tarahumara attire. I closed. I breathed in the sweet scent of flowering cacti. I ran past the thorny ocotillo plants with their garish red buds. At 40 miles, I pulled up to Silvino, motioned for him to follow. We didn't exchange words, but I wanted the two of us to catch Arnulfo. I wanted the three of us to duke it out at the finish line together. Silvino was done, though. I saw Arnulfo at the last turnaround, and he looked spent. We exchanged a glance, and I could see the fatigue and dehydration in his eyes. I knew the look, but I saw something else, too. I saw the fighter in him. I knew he wasn't going to let up. We had 5 miles, and he had 7-8 minutes on me, and I thought I could do it. I made the turn, and pure competitive animal instinct kicked in. This time, it wasn't enough. Arnulfo had it too. He beat me by 6 minutes, less than a mile. I didn't hug him or anything like that. I told him in English, which he didn't understand, that I was very impressed, that he was very strong. In Spanish, I said, "Muy fuerte," over and over. Then I bowed to him, out of respect. People asked me later if I had let him triumph in the interest of cross-cultural understanding or as a gesture of kindness. Those people didn't know how important competing was to me. Arnulfo beat me fair and square. But I returned the next year and got him by 18 minutes. I gave the corn and the $750 to the Raramuri. The Naked Truth. The beautiful thing about running barefoot or in minimal footwear is that you are working with your body's natural proprioception, the ability to sense your own position in space. With nothing between you and the ground, you get immediate sensory feedback with every step, which encourages you to stay light on your feet and run with proper form. Some people, who are recovering from injuries, or who have structural anomalies, or who just like their shoes, will keep lacing up. But whether you wear shoes or go barefoot, what's important is that you pay attention to your form. If running barefoot helps with that, it's beneficial. You want to try barefoot running? Before you toss the shoes and enter a 10K, remember, slow and easy. When runners do too much too soon, injuries often result. First, find an area of grass or sand and take easy 5 to 10 minute runs once or twice a week. Remember, easy. Don't worry about speed at all. You're working on your running form. As long as it feels good, increase the length of one of your runs until you're up to a 20 to 45 minute barefoot run once a week. I like to do 2 to 3 miles on the infield of a track or in a park after an easy run day or for a cool down run after a track workout. Two important things to remember, other than starting slow and easy, are that you don't need to run barefoot all the time to get the benefits, and you don't need to run completely barefoot. Lighter weight, minimal running shoes and racing flats will give you a similar type of feel as running barefoot. It will all help you with form. I have been running most of my long training runs and ultra races in Brooks racing flats for almost a decade, even Badwater and Spartathlon. Racing flats and minimal shoes provide the best of both worlds, comfort and performance. Chapter 16, The Central Governor, Western States 100, 2006. A quote from Mark Davis. All it takes is all you got. No one wants to win more than I do. What I've learned in ultras, though, is that where I finish is merely an outcome. Even though I reach for it with every sinew and tendon and muscle of my being, what matters more than victory is what I do to reach it and how. Have I prepared? Am I focused? Have I been treating my body with attentiveness, eating healthfully and with care? Have I been training properly? Have I pushed myself as far and as hard as possible? Those are the types of questions that have guided me in my career and that can guide anyone who seeks something, which is to say, everyone. You want to get the promotion at work, or the girl, or the guy, or the personal best in the 5K race, of course. But whether you get what you want isn't what defines you. It's how you go about your business. Ultras teach the lesson with unforgiving precision. Never did I see it more clearly than in the Western States 2006, and I wasn't even competing. A month before the race, a friend and running partner asked if I would pace him at the event. I had known Brian Morrison for a year or so. We ran together in the winter and spring of 2006 before I made my trek to Mexico. He was 27, a manager at Seattle Running Company, and he and I would catch the bus to Green Lake, where we did tempo runs, 50 to 60 minutes at 85% effort on the 3-mile loop. We ran on the wooded trails at Cougar Mountain, and I showed him the 12 peaks and the new 40-mile rattlesnake to cougar training route I devised. He asked about the western states' canyons, about the heat, about the hill work we should be doing. He asked me everything, and I told him everything. I don't believe in secrets. It's not a bit of arcane knowledge that will allow me to beat someone or someone to beat me. Winning at an elite level demands technique and strategy, to be sure, but mostly it's heart. Brian had plenty. He had drive and powerful ambition. In many ways, he reminded me of me. It was strange at the starting line, not screaming, not sprinting to the head of the pack. To keep busy, and because I felt as though I owed so much to the race that had, in a way, defined me, I handed out race bibs and volunteered the way I had at many ultras I didn't run. It was weird, following the progress of other runners and visiting with aid station volunteers who helped me out over the past 7 years, but it was pleasant. That's a mild word, but compared to the intense highs and lows I experienced during my previous western states, the extremes to which the event had pushed me, it was exactly right. It was pleasant. What made it more than pleasant was Brian. I had told him before the race that he had what it took to win. For 55 miles, I kept track of his progress from different points on the course. Pacers weren't allowed to run until mile 62, and he did nothing to disabuse me of my confidence. He was moving well, in fifth place, looking fresh and relaxed. But at mile 55, things got less pleasant. That's when Brian started to have a hard time. It was 105 degrees, Western States weather, and I could tell it was affecting him. He was slowing down. I knew that when I joined him, we'd have work to do. I knew we'd have to pick up the pace. I had been up since 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was worried about whether I had it in me. I knew that I could race an ultra myself and win. Being responsible for someone else's success, though, scared me a little. I hadn't anticipated the doubt. I would have to deal with that before I took my first step. I dealt with my anxiety the same way I had dealt with my bum ankle in the 2001 Western States. 4 simple steps. First, I let myself worry. Second, I took stock. I would be doing the equivalent of a 38-mile training run with someone who had been running for the better part of a day. Not a huge deal. Third, I asked myself what I could do to remedy the situation. That was easy. All I had to do was be a good pacer. The fourth and final step, separate my negative feelings from the issue at hand. Realizing my negative feelings had little to do with reality made this step the easiest of all. When I joined Brian, the announcer blared over the speakers, "Scott Jurek is about to pace!" I was merely there to help someone else, but hearing my name out loud like that unleashed a surge of adrenaline into my blood. Then, it was time for business. At mile 62, Brian was in fourth place. I told him that by the time we got to the Rucky Chucky River crossing, 16 miles away, we were going to have passed everyone. I told him we'd be leading then, and we would lead all the way to the finish line. He turned it on. He became a different runner. He didn't say anything, because runners don't talk much. They want to conserve all their energy for the race. But I talked. I turned into Dusty. I became Brian's second brain. Cajoling, sweet-talking, demanding what I needed to demand. Within 12 miles, we had passed everyone. By the time we came to the river crossing, he was hooting and hollering. He was super pumped, even though we were both boiling. I did what I knew how to do, which was to push him as hard as I could, but making sure it wasn't too hard. I made him lie down in creeks, and I shoveled water over him. I remember once having to lie down in a puddle that I immediately realized was half horse manure, but I didn't move. I knew how overheated we both were. I had him drink at aid stations. There was never a point where I thought he wasn't getting enough water, or was getting too much. By mile 78, when we turned to look behind us, there was no one there. We weren't running scared, but when you're in front, you want to send a message to your competitors. Don't even try. I told Brian, let's crank it up. As long as we keep running 8-minute miles, if we throw a 7:30 in every so often, you've got this. We got to Highway 49, over 93 miles in, and I told Brian's crew chief and fiancé, Andrea, that I was going to need someone else to take over. With all my attention to Brian's drinking enough water and eating, I hadn't drunk or eaten enough myself. I was sick to my stomach. I was fatigued. I was dehydrated and bonking. I thought I might slow him down. Andrea asked if I could keep going, to stay with him for another 3 miles until No Hands Bridge, which was 3 miles from the finish. At that point, Brian's victory wouldn't be in question. I could stop then. So I dug in, and we ran another 3 miles through choking dust and heat. Brian told me the downhills hurt, but I told him pain was temporary, to get through it. Otherwise, we didn't say much. There was no need. 3 miles from the finish line, I had pushed him as hard as he needed to be pushed, and when another pacer, Jason Davis, appeared, I told Brian he was in good hands, and I'd meet him at Roby Point, 1 mile from the finish line. I said I'd follow him to his first Western States victory. Brian and Jason climbed another 2 miles on dirt. I caught a ride and met them on the road in Auburn. Brian hadn't seen pavement in some time. There were cars and houses and people having parties in their yards, waiting for the top finishers. Physically, he looked fine. As far as I was concerned, this race was over. All we had to do was jog along city streets to the finish line. All Brian had to do was get there. But when he spoke, I knew he wasn't feeling quite so confident. "How far back are they?" he asked, and he looked over his shoulder. He was scared. I laughed and told him to relax, that he didn't need to worry. We were running slightly uphill, and he was hammering. He was going at an 8-minute-mile pace, and I told him he didn't have to run that fast, but if he wanted to finish strong, that was cool. "How far back are they?" he asked again. "How far back?" I had suffered late race hallucinations myself, and I did my best to not freak out, and especially to make sure he didn't freak out. Luis Escobar, my photographer friend, was running with us now, and so was Jason Davis. We were motoring down the last downhill, and we could hear the crowd. We could see the lights. Brian was yelling, "Where is it? Where is it?" The race ends in Auburn at the Placerville High School track, and we were all yelling back, "It's there! You got this! You got this!" It was 10 at night when we rounded a corner and stepped through the small opening in the fence and onto the track. People were cheering, but not as loud as Lewis, Jason, and I were yelling, "You did this, Brian! You're the Western States champion!" About 7 strides onto the track, our cheers went from "Brian, you did this," to dead silence. 20 feet in, 300 yards from the finish, Brian collapsed. "What's the matter, Brian?" I asked. He said, "I can't get up." I had noticed him weaving on the final downhill, but I had weaved a lot myself in races. The ultra is a brutal thing. "You gotta get up, Brian. You gotta get up." Jason and I helped him stand, but he wouldn't walk. I said, "You gotta keep moving." I was dusty again, but this time nothing seemed to work. Maybe we should have let him stay on the track. He couldn't stand on his own, and now he was babbling, not making sense. It was a really stupid mistake when I look back on it. Jason and I put Brian's arms around our shoulders, and we walked him towards the finish line. We didn't cut across the infield, toward the medical tent. We took him around the track. It was instinct. I was in survival mode, taking care of someone who was in really bad shape, but I was in pacer mode, too, and racer mode. I was in runner mode. I wanted Brian to get what he wanted. I wanted to help him get to the finish line, and I did. We got him to the finish line, and from there, the medical staff took over. One of the doctors asked him if he knew who won the race. "Scott Jurek," he said. "No," the doctor said with a thin smile. "You won. You won the race." Within 15 minutes, he was in an ambulance, and as they were lifting him in it, I was standing next to him, and he looked at me and said, "Scott, I did it. I won the Western States." I was hanging out at the finish line, greeting the next finishers as I always did, and they were happy to see me, but I started hearing other people, onlookers and race board members, saying things. I heard that Brian was going to be disqualified. I heard people saying it was my fault for helping him around the track. And then, finally, a board member walked up to me and said Brian didn't win, and he would be disqualified for accepting help. I told him the board didn't need to do that, that being disqualified was a black mark for a runner, and if anyone deserved sanction, it should be me. I told them if they weren't going to award Brian the victory, the very least they could do was to give him a DNF. Did not finish. Nope. It would have to be a DQ. I thought the board members were just doing it to bolster their egos and make a statement about the sanctity of the race. I walked to the Auburn Hospital the next day. No one from the Western States Board had been there. When I entered Brian's room, he spoke first. "Hey, Scott. Doesn't look like I'm going to be out of here in time for the award ceremony. I want you to accept it for me." I got straight to the point. I said I'd been at the track all night, and that the board had made a big to-do about his not making it to the finish line, and DQ'd him. They had awarded the win to a runner named Graham Cooper, who finished 12 minutes after him. I told him I was sorry, and that I'd wished I could do something to change the board's decision. I told him I was sorry I didn't take him across the infield. I said I knew how hard he had worked and how close he was to winning. I said I knew what being close felt like. I had only recently failed to catch Arnulfo, but that I could only imagine his pain. It was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. When I got back to Seattle, there was already chatter about the race all over the internet. Some of it was unbelievable. I read that I had pushed Brian too hard, that I was his coach. I read that I had not given him enough water and that I had given him too much. I read that I sabotaged his race because I didn't want anyone taking the spotlight off of me. I learned more than one lesson at the 2006 Western States, one I hadn't been expecting. No matter what you do, there are going to be haters out there. My Zen self tells me they are no worse than people who idolize you for the wrong reasons. What people think about you doesn't really matter. The trick is to be true to yourself. People still ask me what happened to Brian. The short answer is, I don't know. The long answer is, it could have been one of many things. I don't believe it was really a medical issue, at least not in the traditional sense. I think Brian stopped because his brain saw the finish line and told his body, "Hey dude, you're done. You did it. You can rest now." And his body shut down. As powerful as our legs are, as magnificent as our lungs and arms and muscles are, nothing matters more than the mind. The Western States doctors identified a number of reasons that might have explained why Brian couldn't make it that one last time around the track. They said that his disorientation and lack of coordination were consistent with hyponatremia. They said he might have been dehydrated, had low blood sugar, that there may have been something wrong with his heart. They suggested, finally, that it was total muscular fatigue. He had pushed himself too hard those final miles leading up to the high school track, and his leg muscles were simply too tired to go on. From a medical perspective, the proximity of the finish line was not an issue. Conventional wisdom holds that our ability to push ourselves and keep pushing is limited by peripheral measures of fitness, such as VO2 max, the amount of oxygen we can use for aerobic respiration, and lactate threshold, the point at which our muscles accumulate lactic acid faster than they can clear it. Efficiency comes into play in determining how well we can exploit our body's fitness level, as does the resilience of our muscles and bones. In an ultra, there are the additional issues of maintaining hydration and nutrition. From this perspective, Brian's body had just had enough, and it could have been any of a number of factors that caused it to happen to him. Science is about objective measurement, so it's understandable that it has an innate bias for things that can be measured. It's easy to put someone on a treadmill and read their VO2 max or take their blood sugar reading and say it's low. It's not possible to measure the mysterious workings of will. In Lore of Running, Dr. Tim Noakes promotes an alternate theory about how our bodies endure exercise. He believes that a central governor in the brain evaluates the athletic task and determines how many muscle fibers should be recruited. In the case of a run, the brain judges how far away the finish line is, compares it to past runs, and sets a pace that, barring accidents, the body can maintain without injury. Push too hard, and the brain ramps up sensations of fatigue and pain, trying to fool you into slowing down. Once you understand this, you can reprogram yourself to go much faster. Noakes teaches us to stop giving credence to negative thoughts that are only related to how close we are to the finish line. The central governor theory is controversial, but it squares with my experience of the sport. I have always run better than I should have, given my physical gifts and my marathon time. I have always said that the ultra is a mental game. Consequently, I don't believe it was necessarily an accident that Brian stopped so dramatically right when he did. I think it's possible Brian's central governor, under tremendous physiological stress, caught sight of the finish line, believed the race was over, and pulled the plug. In the context of a 100-mile race, one lap around a high school track doesn't seem that long, but once Brian's brain had made that decision, it was impossibly far. When the captain jumps ship, you can't help but sink. Brian's collapse was dramatic, and from a medical point of view, provocative. But, as this is the lesson known by anyone who has ever tried with all his will to attain something and fallen short, how Brian finished wasn't what defined him. Collapsing 300 yards from glory made him a fascinating footnote in Western States 100 history, but it didn't make him. Brian put everything he had into an ultra. He was a champion. That year, to me and many others, he was the champion. Posture. To run far, fast, or efficiently, you have to run with proper posture. Keep your shoulders back and your arms bent 45 degrees at the elbow. Allow your arms to swing freely, but don't let them cross the imaginary vertical line bisecting your body. This will create openness in the chest, better breathing, and more balance. Lean forward, but not at the hips. Imagine a rod running through your body from the head to the toes. Keep the rod at a slight forward angle to the ground with a neutral pelvis. When the entire body participates, you're using gravity to your advantage. Remember, running is controlled falling. Chapter 17, Hunted by the Wasatch Speed Goat. Hard Rock 100, July 2007. A quote from Ernest Hemingway. The world breaks everyone, and afterward, some are strong at the broken places. Don't think about your ankle. Dusty was yelling at me again. Would he be yelling at me when we had white hair and canes? Come on, jerker. Don't think about your ankle. Climb. I didn't answer. I was too busy sliding backward down a glassy snowfield, trying to stop my descent with three good limbs. We had just hammered through a steady downpour, up a ridiculously steep 4,400-foot incline through an opening in the Colorado Rockies called Oscar's Pass. The rain had glazed the snow, turning it to ice. We had turned off our headlamps so the record holder who had been stalking me for 70 miles couldn't gauge the distance he had to make up. It was 2 a.m., black, except for a few minutes when lightning bolts strobed the scene. Dusty, standing on a mountain looking down, yelling, of course. Me, crawling, sliding, then crawling some more, dragging what I hoped wasn't a broken ankle. 40 miles earlier, out a cold, windswept little valley, Dusty had taunted a 40-year-old named Carl Meltzer. "You're getting beat by a guy with an ankle the size of a grapefruit," Dusty jeered. Meltzer had just smiled. He had won the Wasatch 100 6 times and was known as the Wasatch Speed Goat. He had also won this event, the Hard Rock 100-Mile Endurance Run, or Hard Rock 100, 4 times. In fact, he held the course record. One of his other nicknames, King of the Hard Rock. "The race doesn't start until Telluride," Meltzer said. Dusty and I had begun our climb to the snowfield from Telluride. I looked back over my shoulder. "Climb! Come on, it's just snow. You're a Nordic skier, you can do this. You've dug deeper before." I wasn't so sure. I had dropped out of the Hard Rock 100 in 2000 after only 42 miles. At the time, I blamed the effort I had expended in my second Western States victory. I had also blamed the altitude. And I blamed the naivete and youthful optimism of two certain Minnesotans. Dusty picked me up at the Denver airport the day before the 2000 race. We drove 8 hours to Silverton, Dusty behind the wheel, me pretzeled on top of plastic bins filled with his construction tools where the back seats used to be. We arrived at 6 p.m., ate and tried to sleep, then stepped to the starting line at 6 a.m. After winning my 7th Western States, I had decided that, with the proper acclimatization and training, I could conquer the Hard Rock. In June 2007, I had arrived in Silverton, Colorado, a month before the race. Then, 2 nights before the event, I had sprained my ankle. I had been camping at Molas Lake at 11,000 feet, sucking in the thin air, almost feeling my marrow pumping out more oxygen-carrying red blood cells. Mornings, I lingered with locals and other runners at the Avalanche Cafe on unpaved Blair Street. To save money, I made my own breakfast and brewed my yerba mate. Late morning, I headed into the mountains to learn the secrets of the course. My guide and companion was Kyle Skaggs, a 22-year-old emerging ultra-runner who was spending the summer as a research assistant at the Mountain Studies Institute, a non-profit organization dedicated to examining the ecology and climate of high-altitude locations. Kyle, along with his brother Eric, would go on to become the best-known and in certain quarters the most idolized siblings on the ultra scene. Lean, ruggedly handsome, and irrepressible, the pair were referred to as the Young Guns and the Jonas Brothers of Trail Running on the running forums. They have doubtlessly increased the recent female interest in the sport. When he worked at Oregon's Rogue Valley Runner Shop, Kyle was famous for drawing huge numbers of women who asked him to analyze their gait, but never bought shoes. The brothers had been born and raised in rural New Mexico, and along with a dedication to mountain living and environmentalism, they would go on to approach races with a blithe aggressiveness that shocked racing veterans. Kyle would not be running the Hard Rock in 2007, but he knew the mountains and knew racing strategy. Together, we explored some of the trickier portions of the course, climbing endless switchbacks, sprinting ridges, descending boulder fields, and crossing a number of snowfields, including a few 50-degree slopes where, if we had slipped, we almost certainly would have died. Even though the Hard Rock contained as many perils as I ever had seen on a course, the dangers fit into a majesty I had never encountered. In many ways, it was not only the toughest course I had ever explored, but the most beautiful. We ran past turquoise lakes, brushed purple columbine and crimson Indian paintbrush. There was the shocking green of the tundra and the blinding white of the snowfields, gold rock and red rock, a sense that seemed as if they would never finish. Endless vistas, deep, cozy valleys, and sharp, cloud-scraping peaks. Many evenings we spent with Kyle's Mountain Studies Institute colleague, a 30-something from India named Imtiaz. We cooked meals together in the organization's kitchen. Kyle made mushroom quesadillas and Imtiaz made eggplant curry and dal with basmati rice. The kitchen was full of mouth-watering aromas, and we sautéed tomatoes and zucchini with ginger, cumin, and mustard seeds. We discussed the subtleties of spices in Indian cuisine and the benefits of Ayurvedic medicine. Years of eating plants had convinced me that the best way to get well and to stay well was to eat simply and to avoid processed foods whenever possible. After my epiphany in the first internship with an old man and his hospital food, I tried to treat injuries and illness with natural remedies whenever possible. Food was my medicine. I even avoided anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen, which other long-distance runners gobbled by the handful. I thought it masked pain so much that I might risk serious injury by running when I shouldn't. I had also heard too many stories of runners taking so much ibuprofen that they damaged their kidneys. It was a classic case of treating symptoms, of wanting the quick fix. It was, in many ways, typical Western medicine. By the week of the race, after nearly a month of workouts, simple living, and a lot of new vegan food, I was devouring 13,000-foot peaks and 30-mile journeys without the sensation of breathing through a cocktail straw. Even Kyle, with his fresh 22-year-old muscles and 2 months of altitude training, was surprised I was pushing the pace on our weekly ascents on Kendall Mountain. High altitude? I was ready. I had to be. The Hard Rock includes 11 mountain passes, 6 of them over an elevation of 13,000 feet, and also climbing a 14er, a 14,000-foot peak, a total vertical climb and descent of 66,000 feet, more than would be involved in climbing and descending Mount Everest from sea level, as the race organizers like to point out. 2 nights before the race, I joined a Youth Dare program soccer game on a grassy field not far from the town's 100-year-old cemetery. That's where I tore my ankle ligaments when trying to steal the ball from a 7-year-old. I gulped glass after glass of turmeric soy milk and lay for hours with my leg elevated with a bag of ice wrapped around my bulging ankle. I dosed myself with the homeopathic remedy Arnica Montana and with pineapple enzyme bromelain. It wasn't enough. The pain electric-eeled my synapses. There was no way I could run the race. Imtiaz watched me limp into the Mountain Studies kitchen and asked if he could take a look. He ground a scoop of black pepper and added turmeric, flour, and water until it was a thick, heavy paste. He pressed the paste onto paper towels, then wrapped them around my ankle. I dragged myself into my tent that night, and Dusty saw the compress. "Jerker, you might want to consider some vitamin I, ibuprofen, this time," he said. By the time I was scrambling up the snowfield, I had covered 79 miles on that ankle. The toughest section was yet to come. The race course, dubbed as Wild and Tough, was not a course you'd wanted to run on a freshly sprained ankle. At times, it followed animal paths, and other times there was no trail, only trail markers to navigate scree slopes and snowfields. 19.5 hours earlier, in a gymnasium of the Silverton High School, I had applied a new Imtiaz special compress, then clamped a Protec ankle sleeve and air cast over it. Over that, I wrapped so many layers of duct tape that it was 2 inches thick. The last time I had seen the ankle, even after 2 days of treatment, it shined, purple as the inside of a thundercloud. It was so swollen, I couldn't see my ankle bones. My injury provided a great excuse to lose, but I didn't want an excuse. The truth is, in this race, even on a good ankle, I would have been running, if not scared, then at least supremely wary. Anyone who knew the San Juan Mountains would be doing the same. A man named Joel Zucker had died of a brain aneurysm after running the 1998 Hard Rock, and scores of people had been injured over the years. Hard Rockers knew that, but they kept running. Hard Rockers had run until blood leaked from their capillaries under their flesh, which made their hands turn into catcher's mitts and their feet into clown shoes. But they kept running. Some veteran hard rockers even chuckled at the sight. On the other hand, pulmonary edema, where the blood seeps into the lungs, could be fatal. Still, past runners had heard moist wheezing deep in their chests, finished the race, and then been driven over Molas Pass to the Durango Hospital with fluid in their lungs. Dozens of runners' guts milkshaked during the course. There was always plenty of puking, not to mention an abundance of hallucinations. Racers watched boulders turn into Subarus, trees morph into masses of laughing worms. They mistook stumps for severed elk heads. The slowest runners had the most visions, probably because their sleep deprivation was more extreme. The Hard Rock has a 48-hour time limit. Dawdlers could pretty much count on phantom hikers joining them for the last few miles of the course. Some of the poltergeists told jokes. The first year of the race, 1992, only 18 of the 42 entrants finished. Racers had to cut down tree limbs that were blocking the course. The winner knocked on the door of a trailer at the finish line to alert the race officials that he was done. Nowadays, the organizers set up aid stations at intervals on the course, but they had set up many fewer than other 100-mile mountain races. Hard rockers speak with a disdain that sometimes approaches contempt of races like the Leadville Trail 100, which is more famous and more popular, has more corporate sponsors, and which, compared to the Hard Rock, is running over some hills. The Western States is an interesting and famous event, but those Californians who speak of it as the most grueling of ultras? To Hard Rockers, they're amusingly provincial. Some Hard Rock highlights? At least one sleepless night and usually two waist-deep river crossings. Harrowing exposure to heights, fixed ropes, and steps cut into snowfields, tundra, and rock, hopping cross-country where no trail exists. Another feature of the race, scree fields that crumble under your feet as you spin in place. You might think that an event that taxes the human body so mercilessly would have inspired a history of healthy eating. You would be wrong. Next to a typical old-school hard rocker, the most ravenous catfish in the world is a finicky gourmet eater. For breakfast, especially in the 1990s, the race pioneers tended to scarf donuts and slug back multiple helpings of bacon and sausage links. Lunches and dinners often included pepperoni pizzas and greasy cheeseburgers. Not until the race itself, though, did the early hard rockers make the bewhiskered bottom feeders look prissy. The legendary ultramarathoner and mountain racer Rick Trujillo, who lives just over the mountain from Silverton in Ouray, Colorado, won the Hard Rock in 1996 on a diet of Mountain Dew and Oreos. He continued his promiscuous diet until 2007, when at age 59 he was rushed to the hospital with chest pains. He eats more salads nowadays. Only about half of the Hard Rock entrants make it to the finish line. If a racer doesn't make it out of each station by a prescribed time, based on the 48-hour maximum, he or she is told the race is over. Getting timed out, especially after 60 or 70 or 80 miles, is such a bitter experience that many racers have pleaded to go on. Some have actually threatened the aid station crews. And emphatic but firm organizers have had to address the issue in the race handbook. You are all experienced ultra runners. Do not debate cutoff times with the aid station personnel. This is a dangerous course, according to that handbook, a fantastic compendium of arcane statistics, numbingly detailed course descriptions, hair-raising terrors, and chilling understatement. When it comes to the temptation to scale peaks during storms, for example, the manual advises, you can hunker down in a valley for 2 to 4 hours and still finish, but if you get fried by lightning, your running career may end on the spot. Regarding minor problems, the manual advises crew members, you may also see, in the later stages of the run, runners who are extremely depleted in sugar and dehydrated. They usually will be extremely fatigued and may be nauseated and vomiting. In addition to trail running, the manual says, You will do some mild rock climbing, Hans required, wade ice-cold streams, struggle through snow which at night and in the early morning will be rock-hard and slick, and during the heat of the day will be so soft you can sink to your knees and above, cross cliffs where a fall could send you 300 feet straight down, used fixed ropes as handrails, and be expected to be able to follow the course with a map. Volunteers placed plastic flags along the course every year until marmots started gobbling them. Now they use reflective metal markers. By the time I had made it through the snow to join Dusty, we stood at Oscar's Pass. We had just climbed 4,400 feet, and if I had not known better, I might have felt an instant of lightning-lit, semi-crippled relief. But I did know better. I followed D-Ball as he ran down the backside of the mountain towards a hellish crevasse called Chapman Gulch. I bounded down a series of boulder-strewn switchbacks. Dusty claimed later that he looked back and saw me using the brace to wedge my foot between rocks. I didn't realize it at the time, though, probably because my neurosynapses were sizzling from a massive overload of "aye!" impulses. It would have been painful on 2 good feet. I had survived descents as rocky and steep before, though. What I had not survived was what I encountered when we reached the bottom. The awesomely awful genesis of the most difficult climb of the course, a treacherous, hope-suckingly steep scramble over boulders, gravel, and loose scree to Grant's Swamp Pass. In 1998, as the 2-time hard rock champion David Horton was ascending this section of the race, a melon-sized rock dislodged by a runner above fell and struck his right hand. A little later, Horton wrote in his account of that race, I noticed that my glove was soaked through with blood. After finishing, of course, he realized that it was a compound fracture. Horton's story was shocking, but not singular. Just as the hard rock is the toughest ultra around, it tends to draw the toughest ultra runners. Laura Vaughn, who set a woman's record at the Hard Rock in 1997, the only year she ran it, also was the first person to finish the Wasatch Front 100 for 10 consecutive years and the first woman to break 24 hours. That makes her fast. What makes her tough, though, what makes her a bona fide hard rocker, is that in 1996, 9 weeks after giving birth to a son, she ran the Wasatch and breastfed her baby at the aid stations. Her 10-year ring from the event is engraved, Lactating Laura. Tough? Carolyn Erdman entered the Hard Rock for the first time in 1997. She was 48 years old. She made it 85 miles before the race organizers told her she was moving too slowly and that she was done. In 1998, she entered again. 4 weeks before the event, she ran a 50-mile warm-up in Orem, Utah. 3 miles into it, she fell and scraped her left knee. There was blood and a little pain, but she thought it was no big deal. By the time she finished, she could see her patella. She was shocked at how white it was. The doctor in the emergency room told her she was lucky he didn't amputate the limb. She spent a week in the hospital with intravenous antibiotics. Surgeons operated on her twice. The next year, she ran again and was timed out at mile 92. The next year, on her fourth and final attempt, she timed out at mile 77. Tough? Kirk Apt started vomiting at mile 67, the first time he ran the Hard Rock, and 3 hours later he was still vomiting. On his next race attempt, his quadriceps cramped at mile 75, so he hobbled the last quarter of the course. He won the race in 2000, the year I dropped out. He finished the race 16 times and counting. The rock was worse than the snow. The climb was crueler. I had been racing for 22 hours. I had been racing for what seemed like my whole life. The race doesn't start till Telluride? I wolverined the rocky ground and willed my good leg and kept pushing. For each step I took forward, I would only gain half a step as the loose scree crumbled from underfoot. I was climbing hard, but hardly moving. Where was Meltzer? Had he turned his headlamp off? He couldn't have won 4 hard rocks without being ruthless. Tough? Sometimes you just do things. Somehow, we made it over. We crested the pass and bounced down the other side. My ankle didn't hurt anymore. I couldn't feel it at all. At 4 a.m., after another climb and another descent, the land took shape around us. The blackness turned into mere dark, then into gray, and finally a pale, wonderful dawn. Watching the glow of a new day in those mountains was almost a religious experience. Some people wonder if a hard rocker ultra-runner in the throes of exhaustion and near agony can enjoy the scenery. As I navigated my way down the final gnarly descent, I didn't just enjoy it. I reveled in it. I wallowed. We heard the sound of a running stream, and we both knew what that meant. We were 2 miles from Silverton and the finish line. "Let's get this bad boy done," Dusty said. "I need a nap." We crossed the finish line at 8:08 a.m. in 26 hours and 8 minutes. It was 31 minutes faster than Meltzer's record. I sat down and removed my elaborate ankle protection, still purple and swollen to twice its normal size. I made occasional trips to the high school to use the bathroom, shower, get something to eat, and take a short nap. But for the next 21 hours, 52 minutes, and 29 seconds, I spent most of my time in the dirt at the finish line. I wanted to greet the other 96 finishers, especially my sea-level compatriot, ultra-studette Chrissy Mayle, who finished third place overall, setting a new women's course record a mere 25 minutes behind Meltzer. In ultra-running, the mountains and willpower equalize the genders. Chapter 18. In the Footsteps of Pheidippides. Spartathlon, September 2007. A quote from Hippocrates. "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." 2 months later, my sprain was healed, and I was filled with the optimism and joy that only winning a 100-mile mountain race on a bum ankle can bring. All that good stuff was very fortunate, because I was about to begin a 152-mile race with a broken toe. It was called the Spartathlon, and even though I had won it the year before, a few months after my second Badwater victory, I knew that this year would be more difficult. It's always easier to sneak up on someone than to defend a title. The Spartathlon begins at the base of the Acropolis in Athens, and ends in front of the statue of King Leonidas in Sparta, a distance of 245.3 kilometers, 152.4 miles. The course is predominantly road racing, 95%, with some improved dirt roads, 4%, and a small section of mountainous trail, 1%. The elevation ranges from sea level to 3,937 feet, climbing a few mountain ranges for a total elevation gain of over 8,000 feet. In addition to the sheer length of the course, runners are challenged by the potent Greek sun and coastal humidity. In the heat of the day, temperatures can reach 90 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The total overall time limit for the course is set at 36 hours, but there are 75 race control points, each with its own time cutoff. Approximately half of the 300 or so starters finish each year. Volunteers at the aid stations offer water, nectar juices, sodas, bread, yogurt, as well as other items, and runners are allowed to leave drop bags at any of the aid stations, so it is theoretically possible to run this race without a crew. No pacers are allowed. I ran the Spartathlon in 2006 because of its reputation. I returned in 2007 because of my experience that first year and because of what I had learned of the history of the race. The most famous long-distance race with a Greek origin is the Marathon, which celebrates the arduous journey of the messenger who ran from Marathon to Athens, a distance of 26.2 miles, to announce Greece's victory over the Persians in 490 BC. He then dropped dead from exhaustion. Though Pheidippides is the messenger most often credited with the noble and fatal trip, the runner was probably named Eucles, according to the ancient writer Plutarch. The real story of Pheidippides, according to those same historians, is much better and has a happier ending. It also inspired the modern Spartathlon. The Persian fleet was on a roll. They had plundered their way through the Greek islands, sacked the city-state of Eretria, and then had their sights set on Athens. The Athenians sent a small force, commanded by General Miltiades, to seal off the exits from the Bay of Marathon, named after the ancient Greek word for the fennel that probably grew wild there. The ancient historian Herodotus writes that the Athenian generals dispatched Pheidippides to the great city of Sparta to ask for reinforcements and holding off the much larger invading force. Pheidippides reached Sparta the day after he left Athens, but his plea fell on deaf ears. Although sympathetic to their fellow Greeks' plight, the religious Spartans were in the middle of a festival to Apollo and could not wage war until the full moon. It must have been a long 152.4 miles back home with the bad news, but luckily Pheidippides had something else to report. While running through the mountains above the ancient city of Tegea, checkpoint 60 of the modern Spartathlon, he had a vision of the nature god, Pan. The son of Hermes, the divine messenger, Pan ruled over shepherds, nymphs, and rustic places. He was a great guy to have on your side in a big battle because he could induce a wild fear in mortals called panic. This god called Pheidippides by name and bade him ask the Athenians why they paid him no attention. Though he was of goodwill to the Athenians, had often been of service to them, and would be in the future. If we read it closely, everything we need to know about running is in Pheidippides' story. He ran over 300 miles, the first half in a little over one day, and he didn't even get what he wanted. If you run long enough, that tends to happen. Whatever quantitative measure of success you set out to achieve becomes either unattainable or meaningless. The reward of running, of anything, lies within us. As I sought bigger rewards and more victories in my sport, it was a lesson I learned over and over again. We focus on something external to motivate us, but we need to remember that it's the process of reaching for that prize, not the prize itself, that can bring us peace and joy. Life, as countless posters and bumper stickers rightly attest, is a journey, not a destination. Pheidippides kept going, and he ended up getting something even better, something outside the normal realm of human experience. Nature itself called out his name. Pan is nature incarnate, and it gave the great runner a sacred message to bring home to his people. The message was pretty much what nature's message always is. Pay more attention to me, and I will help you the way I've always helped you in the past. Pheidippides recounted his vision to the Athenian generals, who took it seriously and erected a new temple to Pan after the war. Unable to wait until the Spartans arrived, the Athenians charged the Persians. The Athenians fought with legendary courage, dividing and conquering the Persian force. Their underdog victory at Marathon is considered the tipping point in the Persian Wars, heralding the golden age of Greece. The Spartathlon, first run in 1983, was the brainchild of Wing Commander John Foden, a native Australian on the verge of retirement from the British Royal Air Force. Foden's 40-year military career included service in the Korean War, the Suez Crisis, the Brunei Revolt, and the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, but he was also an avid amateur athlete and a student of the classics. One day, while reading Herodotus, he started wondering if Pheidippides' legendary run was something within a modern runner's power. John and four buddies from the RAF decided to make the attempt. In the words of Irishman John McCarthy, "We established a credible and historically correct route using ancient military roads, pilgrim ways, dry riverbeds, and goat tracks, taking into consideration the ancient political alignments and enemy states to be skirted." The five runners set off from Athens on October 8, 1982, and the three Johns succeeded, arriving in Sparta in front of the statue of Leonidas on October 9th. John Shulton in 35.5 hours, John Foden in 36 hours, and John McCarthy in just under 40 hours. They decided to establish a yearly run that, in the Olympic vein, would offer no prize money or commercial gain, but would